Well, a gracious good evening, brothers and sisters. Good to see you here.
Are you buckled up?
I'll tell you what, this is one of the funkiest chapters in the Old Testament, if not in the whole of Scripture. Man, you got murder, mayhem, rape, incest, dismemberment, topped off with a little thermonuclear destruction. If you fall asleep tonight, it is not on me, okay? I just want you to know. Oh, goodness. This really is quite the adventure. This is Genesis chapter 19. And I've got so much to get through tonight. We don't even need to do much of a review. You guys remember, you know, Abraham of the tent, heat of the day, the three visitors come by, boom, there they are. And one of them happens to be the Lord, and just refreshes Sarah and Abraham's memory and says, no, this is not a symbol coming up. Be patient. Within the year, you will actually give birth to the child of promise. Here it comes. And this time it's Sarah's turn to laugh, and she learns a little lesson. And then Abraham gets a lesson in righteousness. The Lord kind of sets him up, lets him know that he's going to destroy, or intends to destroy Sodom for all the sin that is there. And almost as an offhand comment. And he does it in such a way that Abraham is a little upset because he's not used to this offhand attitude from the Lord. And Abraham is concerned that there might be some righteous people, some innocent people that get hurt in the judgment of the city. And so he proceeds to debate with the Lord. And you know, you can almost sense the Lord kind of smiling tongue in cheek. Well, okay, I'll save it for 45. Oh, all right, 40, yeah. Yeah. 30, yeah, okay. 20. It's just what he's drawing from Abraham is Abraham's willingness to be in a very ticklish situation. Yeah, I'm teaching God how to be righteous. But Abraham really is concerned. He's really jealous that God's actions and his character not be put into question in the eyes of the world, and he's willing to take a risk to make sure that's true. He finally argues the Lord down to 10 people. Did it make a difference? Not a whit. And the Lord knew that. He wasn't really changing his mind. He knew this was going on all the time. But he was very interested in giving Abraham a chance to pitch for these folks. I mean, that it really pleased God. It pleased his heart that Abraham should do that. And in the meantime, the other two travelers, head on down the road towards Sodom. And what we're going to see tonight, though it's really, there are three parts of this chapter. In the first one, as you know, the travelers will arrive. They'll confirm the Lord was right. It's as bad as he thought it was. And yes, they are slated for destruction. And not only that, the people of Sodom gather and are eager to abuse the travelers, which the travelers do not allow. And then the second part of this chapter is the destruction itself. And like two verses, whew, when he starts moving, he cooks. I mean, you don't want to wait around. And then there's a really odd little epilogue on the end of the chapter about Lot and his two daughters. Well, it kind of goes a lot of different places, so I'm not going to strain it. I'm just going to jump right in. We get into about 72 really controversial issues this evening. So we might as well get started. And my email is rickboya@trail. Okay. Genesis chapter 19. Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. And when Lot saw them, he rose to meet them and bowed down with his face to the ground. Okay, just right off the bat, I have to say, I have no idea if this is the same day that they were talking with Abraham or not. If they were walking all the way from Abraham's camp, it's about 20 miles, and it's really hot. So I'm thinking maybe it'll be the following evening. 20 miles a day in the desert, that's good. But they're angels. So maybe it's the same day. I don't know. There's no clue. We have no idea. Did they get transported down, or did they actually walk? They're there, and they're there in the evening. Now, Lot is sitting in the city gates. I'm looking out here. Most of you guys are old Bible students. You know what that means. You know, the big dogs hang out in the city gates. The wise men, you know, the head merchants, the main contractors, you know, the mayor. Not only to see who's coming in, but that's where really court is held. If there's a problem, you know, they catch an adulteress or something like that, they drag them to the city gates because these are the men who function as judges. Well, there is Lot. Obviously, he's gained some prestige over the years with these guys. It really doesn't say anybody's with him, but I have to figure that there's a few of the guys there with him. So I don't know, maybe because, you know, Abraham rescued everybody in Sodom. Remember 15 years ago, he rescued him from the kings. Lot traded on that, and he's got some gravitas as a result. Now, Lot's reaction, he bows down, his face to the ground. You know, as I read through the passage, I'm not sure he knows they're angels at this stage, but he knows they're special. And even the commentators kind of quipped that this very possibly is the inspiration for Hebrews 13:2, where the author of Hebrews says that many have entertained angels unaware. Could be. Just remember that. Verse 2. And he said, Lot, now behold my lords, please turn aside into your servant's house, and spend the night and wash your feet. Then you may rise early and go on your way. He's being just as hospitable as Abraham was. He's got the forms down. They said, however, no, but we shall spend the night in the square. Yet he urged them strongly, so they turned aside to him and entered his house. And he prepared a feast for them and baked unleavened bread. That's quick, hurry-up bread. Bakes really quickly, and they ate. Now, Lot apparently has no illusions about the wisdom of their camping in the town square. It's a little bit like camping on the Bear Creek Greenway between Talent and Ashland. Come on, you guys. It's not good. I mean, there are places, almost any town in America, where you should not probably camp. We've got them. But in the town square, you'd think, well, that's probably okay. That's where the police hang out. You know, that's the police station is right there, the fire station. But in this town, no. There's another passage in Scripture that has a very similar story, and we'll touch on that. So Lot, when he hears their plan, he is definitely freaked out. He knows what's going to happen. He says, no, you guys, you have to get in shelter. You have to be in safety. And he almost drags them in. Because remember, if he's not alone at the city gate, everybody knows that there's new entertainment in town. This is not a big city. You know, Sodom, figure it would be reasonable to say there's 400, 500 people. Kind of on the Prospect, Butte Falls type of size. I mean, by afternoon, everybody knows, or by evening, everybody knows. There's not a lot of privacy. And the next verse reveals this. Verse 4, before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, surrounded the house, both young and old, all the people from every quarter. Now, this does not refer to every single man in Sodom. You know, the houses are kind of scrunched together, so they're not going to have, 100, 200 guys. What this means to tell us is everybody in Sodom was represented there. There are no nice neighborhoods in Sodom. You know, there were representatives of the young in Sodom. There were representatives of the old in Sodom. Every neighborhood had sent its local hoods. You know, this is a little bit scary. They called a lot. They said to him, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may have relations with them." I'll clue you in right now. They are not talking about a hand of bridge, just so you know. I mean, this is a little bit like, you know, maybe you can't afford Cabo San Lucas, so you and the spouse head down to Oaxaca, you know, and all of a sudden in the middle of the night, there's this banging on the door, and you peek through the curtain, there's about 30 or 40 guys from the local drug cartel outside your door, and they look like they're from the cartel. That's what's going on here. This would scare you to death if it was you. If you're an angel of destruction sent especially from the Lord, you're not worried so much. But Lot is worried. This actually, I can tell you guys, this is an outcome, the way these people are behaving, this is an outcome of Baal worship. Whenever you see Baal worship, and as I said earlier, in some ancient documents that were unearthed in Syria not too long ago, we actually have vivid descriptions of Baal worship. This is part of it. I mean, maiming, killing, raping, murder, sacrifices. This is what's going on in Baal worship. You know, 6 centuries after this chapter, when Joshua is bringing the people into the promised land, actually Moses hasn't even died yet. I think they're camped out down in the valley. I don't know if you remember, what have I got here? It's Numbers chapter 25. Many in the camp are seduced by the Baal worshipers. And before you know it, thousands of the Israelites are just fornicating all over the place with the Baal worshipers. And the Lord sends a plague. And it's the priest Phinehas that grabs a spear and starts killing people that makes the Lord take the plague. They killed 24,000 people by the plague. And only Phinehas, the Lord says, the only reason I'm sparing you guys is because Phinehas remembered. Now that sounds really awful to us. But let me turn the page again to what actually is even a worse passage than this. It's Judges 19. Do you guys remember that story? There's a Levite who lives, 20 miles north of Jerusalem in the hill country of Ephraim. And his concubine runs away, runs back to Jerusalem, runs all the way to Bethlehem, maybe 50 miles. And she's gone for 4 months, and he finally gets tired of that. He says, "I paid good money for her. I'm going to go get her." So off he goes. And the father of the concubine of the girl entertains him for about a week, finally lets him go, and he takes the girl, and they almost make it back home. They make it just past Jerusalem to the town of Gibeah. And they're going to camp out in the city square. And as it turns out, a contract worker who happens to be staying there temporarily walks by at the end of the working day and he says, "Oh, I don't think you guys should camp here." And he takes them to his house. And it's the same thing. About halfway through the night, a mob shows up. They demand that the guy send out his guest. And he said no, and they offer up the concubine and the virgin daughter. And the concubine somehow is the only one that ends up going out there. And they rape and torture her all night long until she's dead and leave her on the threshold of the door. And after that, the Levite wakes up later in the morning, goes to the door, sees the concubine laying there. "Okay, get up, let's go." I can see why she left him. I mean, seriously. But he then realizes she's dead, puts her on the donkey, takes her home, cuts her body into 12 pieces, and sends them to each piece of territory of Israel. Well, it does create a huge stir, but it's to read this, it just tears your heart out, thinking about this poor, terrified girl. You know, when the Lord sends Joshua and the legions of Israel into Canaan with orders to kill every man, woman, and child, have you ever been asked this by your unbelieving friends? How could God be that cruel? These are fat, sassy Americans asking you, who have no idea what real cultural evil looks like. These are people who feed their children to Molech. I just roll the screaming babies into the fire. I'm not trying to gross you guys out, but I really want you to appreciate that when God says, no, I need this to be erased, I'm ready to start over, he's dead serious. Don't worry about the innocent babies. He's got the innocent babies. But he needs this culture to be erased. And frankly, Israel failed to do that. And it bothered them a long time after. The guys that did this to the concubine, they were Benjamites. They were the sons of Benjamin. They were Israelites, God's people. Yeah, one of the real pros to making a Bible study like this tonight in Genesis 19 is to realize how much God hates sin. However much he might love his creatures, you know, if you're standing next to ground zero when he delivers his judgment on sin, whether he loves you or not, you're going to be vaporized, which is why it's so important to be insulated from sin by the blood of Christ. Man, oh man, oh man. Yeah, this is nasty stuff. You know, the worst offense offered by these people, both the Benjamites and what the Sodomites are about to do, it's not even the rape or the sexual immorality. It's not even the violence. It is the relational betrayal that this entails. You guys remember we were talking about Eastern codes of behavior and hospitality, the sacred responsibility to, once you receive a guest, I mean, we have hospitality here, but it's nothing like in the Middle East. In the Middle East, if you receive your worst enemy, the guy that killed your family, into your tent, you are now responsible for his life, to feed him, protect him. So as we get into this story, and Lot is offering up his daughters, I want you to just, please don't judge it with a 21st century American mind. Understand that it's now Lot's responsibility to protect the guests with any resource at his disposal, his life, his children. Anybody see the movie Lone Survivor, the one about the seal? Have you guys seen that yet? It's a true story. It's Mark Wahlberg plays the seal. Squad of SEALs goes out, get caught in an ambush. They get wiped out by the Taliban. There's one guy left. He's like shot in 600 places. He falls down three cliffs, so the Taliban loses him. And he ends up crawling into an Afghan village. And they take him and shelter him and nurse him, bandage his wounds. When the Taliban shows up the next day to claim him with, you know, all 40 of them with their automatic weapons and RPGs, the village elder says, no, you can't have him. He's our guest. So you ask yourself, you know, it's called Nanawatai, I think, is the actual code. And it's less Muslim than it is simply Eastern. Is that a less moral decision for the village elder to make than what Lot does? Because what he's doing, the seal finally escapes, because if he doesn't, they're going to slaughter the whole village. But when that village elder extends that coverage to the wounded seal, the enemy of the Taliban here, is that less moral than what Lot does? I'm not saying what Lot did was right. His foolishness put him in an impossible spot. He is literally, he's made choices that land him between the rock and the hard place. There's no good out. But he does what he can. And I just, as you read this, I would just really encourage you to view this not with an American 21st century modern view. View this as a person that is familiar with God's law, and see that honestly, Lot's trying hard to do this. It's crazy. I'll give you another sidebar. that relational betrayal is going to offer us another surprise. When we consider homosexuality, I had somebody ask me this the other day, and it made me think about it. When we consider homosexuality as a sin and an offense to God, and we do, rightly so, you know, it's a temptation in our minds to separate it from other sexual sins like fornication and adultery. But Paul in Romans 6 says the sin lies in the fact that we, well, it's not in Romans 6, 1 Corinthians, I'll find it. But he says the sin lies in doing what your flesh is telling you to do. You make flesh your God. And so really, fornication, adultery, homosexuality are all sexual sins. As a matter of fact, what we're taught in seminary is to gauge by the number of times you see it in Scripture that God condemns an act and how intense his condemnation is. You know, the worst sexual sin by that criteria is adultery, by far. Because adultery is, again, relational betrayal. You know, when Israel goes to other gods, God doesn't accuse them of fornication or homosexuality. What does he accuse them of? You adulterers. I'm sending the Assyrians on you people. You know, guys, I'm not saying endorse homosexuality or any of the sexual sins. What I'm saying is carry into that discussion a little humility, because you remember when Jesus said, all you need to do is look on one another with lust and you're guilty. I'm sorry, I must be guilty in the last 30 years 100 times over, 1,000 times over. That puts us in some pretty slimy company, which means the only thing that protects us is God's grace. So I just encourage you, you know, you want to know how to deal with your nephew that just came out, you know, or your neighbor, the good neighbor across the way that has identified himself as gay. You know what? Just picture, you know, your cousin Ernie that sleeps around. You know, you don't have to endorse it. You don't approve of it. But you're a little more comfortable sharing, loving that person and sharing your life with them and trying to talk to them, trying to win them from that position, trying to speak God's wisdom and his love into their life. If you are confronted with a loved one who's embracing the homosexual lifestyle, don't freak out. No more than you would for a loved one who's embracing some other sexual immorality. I hope that that actually makes it easier for you to witness to those people in your family. Because if it hasn't happened to you yet, in this culture, it's gonna. I promise you. Okay, I didn't mean to get crazy on that. But I just want you to understand, when God takes Sodom out, I want you to know where he's coming from. Yes, yes, the rape, the homosexuality, the murder, but the relational betrayal is at the root of this. Because it goes deep. Well, Lot is still going to try a little bit more. He says, please, my brothers, verse 7, do not act wickedly. Actually, he's pretty gutsy. I mean, he's out there facing down 30 drug cartel guys, basically. So he's trying to protect his guest as much as he can. Now, behold, I have two daughters who have not had relations with men. Please let me bring them out to you and do to them whatever you like, only do nothing to these men, inasmuch as they've come under the shelter of my roof. Boy, it is still easy to be shocked by what seems like callous disregard, but I promise you, Lot is not feeling callous and he's not feeling insensitive. He's feeling just what you would do if you were stuck and the only thing you had to bargain with were your children. Lot's feeling it. But they said, stand aside. Furthermore, they said, they're talking about Lot, this one came in as an alien. You know, they remember when he showed up 15 years ago. And already he's acting like a judge. Now we will treat you worse than them. So they pressed hard against Lot and came near to break the door. Well, so much for Lot's social standing in the new community. But the men, the angels, reached out their hands And they brought Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. This is interesting. This is not the normal Hebrew word for blindness. It's a word that means like dazzle. And it only shows up one other time, and it's the same context. What it describes as I'm reading it, honestly, it's as if the angels threw out one of those SWAT team flashbangs. Do you guys know what those are? You know, it's like a quarter stick of dynamite. I'd give you the sound effect, but it would scare Bob to death and ruin our sound system. But what it does, I mean, it's enough of a boom that it stuns you. And it's built with phosphorus light, so it blinds you. I mean, yeah, for 15, 20 seconds, you're helpless. And that's when the SWAT team breaks in and takes down the terrorists. That's what it sounds like to me. These guys are not a problem. You realize the rest of the passage, we don't hear from this crowd. This mob is done. So whatever those angels did, it's long-lasting and effective. Then the men, the angels, verse 12, said to Lot, "Whom else do you have here? A son-in-law, your sons, your daughters? Whomever you have in this city, bring them out of the place. For we are about to destroy this place, because their outcry has become so great before the Lord that the Lord has sent us to destroy it." Well, Lot may have had, he may be wondering about their identity up to this point, but I'm pretty sure that at this point, after the flashbangs, and that, well, we're going to destroy the city, pretty sure he's got a clue who they are at this point. You know, just a side note, a short one this time. Please notice the care that God expends on saving not individuals, but families, groups of people, whether the nation of Israel or the house of Lot or the tribe of Abraham. God is really concerned with relationship. There are even verses, remember the one that says, you know, the unbelieving spouse is sanctified by the believing spouse? Wow, that's kind of amazing. And yet it's true. The act of relationship is a sacred thing, you guys. And if you believe, and if you think, and you understand that the triune Godhead is a relationship, there are three persons in there. Let us make man in our image. Forever, before there was anything, before there was a universe, there are three persons in there. God is a relationship. Each of those three persons is a person in relationship. I'm not sure we appreciate the power of relationship to God. So when he blesses Abraham, everybody that hangs with Abraham gets that blessing, including Lot and his family. When he saves Lot, he says, "You bet, everybody you love, everybody under your covering, everybody you have a family relationship with, you better get them in here because we're going to take them with us." Well, I just plant that seed in your brain, guys, when you do future Bible studies. God is very concerned with family, very concerned with relationship. It means a lot to him. So Lot went out, spoke to his sons-in-law who were to marry his daughters, and said, "Get out of this place. The Lord's going to destroy the city." But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. Poor Lot. You know, Abraham debates with God, and Lot can't even get his teenage in-laws to listen. You know, Lot's kind of a pathetic fellow. But we're getting there. So the sons-in-law, they're not having it. They're not believing the old geezer. And when morning dawned, the angels urged Lot, saying, "Up, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be swept away in the punishment of the city." Okay, this is not sunrise we're talking about. This is first light. As a matter of fact, the Arabs in this part of the world define dawn as when there's enough light to hold up a white thread and a black thread and be able to tell the difference. That's how you know it's dawn. And it's within a minute or two. You know, you can have one guy over in that side of the territory and another guy over here. Within a minute or two, they will coordinate an attack by, let's attack at dawn. That's how they do it. So this isn't dawn. We're not seeing the sun. This is just the first little light. And the angel's getting a little anxious. But he, Lot, hesitated. So the men seized his hand and the hand of his wife and the hands of his two daughters, for the compassion of the Lord was upon him. And they brought him out and put him outside the city. Again, did they walk them out, stroll them out, or did we do another? I don't know. And it came about when they had brought them outside that one of the men said, "Escape for your life. Do not look behind you, and do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains, lest you be swept away." But Lot said to them, "Oh no, my lords, now behold, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have magnified your loving kindness, which you have shown me by saving my life. But I cannot escape to the mountains, lest the disaster overtake me and I die." Dude, shut up and run. Slap you. Gosh. "Now behold, this town is near enough to flee to, and it is small. Please let me escape there. Is it not small? That my life may be saved." Okay, I'm not really sure what Lot's thinking here. Is he just a wimp that doesn't want to run to the mountains? I don't know. I'm just flabbergasted. And I'm even more flabbergasted by the response. "And the angel said to him, 'Behold, I grant you this request also, not to overthrow the town of which you've spoken.'" That's jaw-dropping. I'm sorry. If God's angel of destruction told me to run for my life to the mountains, I'm already gone. I'm already there. I'm there. This is almost enabling behavior. Either that or it is amazing grace indeed. "Hurry," the angel said, "escape there. For I cannot do anything until you arrive there." He is under strict orders that Lot and his people not be harmed. Just very interesting. "Therefore, the name of the town was called Zoar, which in Hebrew means insignificant." Is that the name of a town or what? "Well, now the sun had risen over the earth." It's actually more than dawn. "When Lot came to Zoar," I think the angel probably had orders to bring the judgment at the instant of dawn. It's the time everybody would expect, because in the ancient Akkadian practice, their god of the sun was also the god of justice, and they would bring criminals into the court, and at the point of dawn, at the instant of dawn, the sentence would be given and carried out. You know, head chopping, hanging, whatever was going on there. So probably the angel's getting a little bit, "Hey, got my orders, dude, come on." "So the sun had risen over the earth when Lot came to Zoar instantly. Then the Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire from the Lord out of heaven. And he overthrew those cities and all the valley, and all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground." You know, and I am guessing that if you were a survivor of this earth-shattering, mind-rending apocalypse, you'd feel it was worth more than two verses, and you'd probably be right. Where this is, we don't even know exactly where this is. There are no ruins there. There's nothing there. It's the lowest point in the earth, some 1,400 feet below sea level. It's the bottom of the great rift valley that starts up in Syria and heads down through the Gulf of Aqaba and through half of Africa. It's probably the spot where there's the shallowest amount of Earth's crust over a sea of boiling magma and lava. So I'm thinking this is not going to take a lot to turn into a real inferno. Maybe a little earthquake is all he had to do. Releases petroleum-based gases, bitumen, which, if there's any volcanic venting, would instantly turn to flames. Plus, I'm sure that the Lord is able to rain down meteors or whatever else he's doing. This is Hiroshima times 1,000. I mean, literally. You didn't want to be anywhere near this. And somehow, Lot is spared destruction, hiding out in this little tiny gas station town, which is who knows where, how close. So the Lord has obviously got his hand over this little town. He lifts it a little bit later, we'll see. So anyway, Lot and everybody, they're going. But his wife, Lot's wife, from behind him, maybe she was not quite into Zoar just yet. She looked back, became a pillar of salt. There's actually several salt formations in the Dead Sea, each one faithfully labeled Lot's wife, which you can see for a small fee paid to your tourist guide. This poor woman is never even named, obviously a native of Sodom, obviously not enough relationship with her husband to even believe him, trust him, or believe in his God, even though they've raised teenage daughters. So I don't know. Is it cruelty? He told them, don't do it. I don't think it's cruelty. I think the Lord honors our choices. And boy, if that doesn't scare you, I don't know what will. Verse 27, now Abraham arose early in the morning, went to the place where he'd stood before the Lord. And he looked down towards Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the valley. And he saw, behold, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace. If you've ever been close to a really big industrial furnace, we're not just talking smoke, we're talking, you know, that angry billowing that comes out of a fire or a volcano where you can actually see the air shimmering in front of the smoke. I mean, this is intense heat. And it came about when God destroyed the cities of the valley that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow. He was hiding in Zoar. Gosh, I don't know. You know, did the angel have orders and authority to hide Abraham in Zoar and start the apocalypse? And then God came along a couple minutes later and said, oh man, you left him in Zoar. Okay, you got to get out of here. Come on, up into the mountains. I'm just going to waste this whole place. I don't know. But Lot went up from Zoar and stayed in the mountains, and his two daughters with him. For he was afraid to stay in Zoar, and he stayed in a cave, he and his two daughters. So this is like actually the second time that Lot has been saved by Abraham or on Abraham's account by God. Well, Abraham has the Holy Land and the promise of descendants beyond counting, and Lot has two teenagers in a cave. I'm just saying, Lot's choices have not been fruitful. So they're hiding in the cave as the earth is being rent outside. Probably there's air to breathe. I'm not sure how. The Lord is probably protecting the cave somehow. But they start on a new adventure. The firstborn says to the younger, the daughters, you know, our father is old and there is not a man on earth to come into us after the manner of the earth. After what they just saw, honestly, they're thinking, well, no more boyfriends. And frankly, from the look of it, there aren't any, period. We may be it. And instead of trusting, instead of believing what Lot has been telling them, they decide on a plan of their own. Come, let us make our father drink wine and let us lie with him, that we may preserve our family through our father. So they made him drink wine that night, and the firstborn went in and lay with her father. He did not know when she lay down or when she arose. And it came about on the morrow, the firstborn said to the younger, behold, I lay last night with my father. Let us make him drink wine tonight also. Then you go in, lie with him. We may preserve our family through our father. So they made their father drink wine that night also. The younger arose and lay with him. He did not know when she lay down or when she arose. Thus both the daughters of Lot were with child by their father. It's a dumb mistake, but you know, it's the same mistake Sarah and Abraham made with Hagar. They're just trying to hurry things along. They're a little bit worried. You know what is really bad with this? It's rape. It's relational betrayal. I don't think, even in his poorest thinking, that Lot would have held still for this. He would have said, oh, you guys, no. This God has a plan. Not everything is destroyed. Well, the firstborn bore a son and called his name Moab. He's the father of the Moabites to this day. As for the younger, she also bore a son and called his name Ben-Ammi, for he is the father of the sons of Ammon to this day. Two nations born of incest and intrigue, faithless intrigue, and these two nations are destined to be cursed by God, not because of their lineage, but because they end up forever at violent odds with God's people. The Lord made it clear, you remember Ruth from Moab. She's a Moabitess, and yet she is an ancestor of our Lord. So the Lord's not mad at the race. Well, he is mad at the race, but not their individuals in the race. He doesn't condemn everybody in the race because that particular race is foolish. But as a culture, it's just interesting. So gosh, I still got 3 minutes. Plenty of time. We could teach two whole chapters in this 3 minutes. You know, the things I got out of this, you guys, poor Lot. He really is pitiful, even though, you know, Peter in 2 Peter chapter 2 actually calls him righteous. And that really got me thinking. You know, Jim's prayer at the beginning of the service was about our righteousness. And he never said a truer word when he said, you know, it's not anything we do. It's based on faith. Because both Abraham and Lot are counted righteous in God's eyes. And as far as I can tell, there's only one thing they have in common. They believe him. It's the only thing I can find. Well, here are the lessons that I got out of this. Number one, your priorities are your pathway. I don't know if you are confused because you're juggling too many goals or you're juggling too many priorities or objectives. You know, when people come in for counseling, one of the things I encourage them to do is just sit for a while and meditate. Write down a list. What is the most important thing in your life? More important than anything else. More important than your life. What is it that if you had it, you could lay on your deathbed at age 97 and look at it and say, you know, I was successful. My life was a success. If you know what that is, you're good to go. And if you can identify the second and the third and the fourth, you know what that does is it makes your decision-making a lot easier. You know, if you've got a choice between compromising number two and compromising number five, oh, choice is done. You know, I'm sad about number five, but I'm not going to hurt number two. You know, for me, it's my relationship with God. Then it's my relationship with Isla. And then it's like maybe my personal health so I don't die. And then it's you guys. Although I love you guys, I could sacrifice myself if there are enough news cameras and people were cheering and stuff like that. But you know what I mean? If you have priorities clearly in your mind, and maybe even write them down, if Lot had done that, he wouldn't have made so many stupid decisions. He would have honored God. He would not have chosen with his eyes, but with his heart. He would never have gone down to Sodom. He would not have been sucked into the Sodomite culture. But he kind of let himself just get along. You know, I'll just get along. And little, by not being clear in his priorities, he ended up in a terrible place. Matt 6, Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. Seek first his kingdom and righteousness. Everything you need will be added to you. If your priorities are straight, your path will be automatic. You'll just navigate the challenges of this earth. Won't be painless. Won't be without trials, but you'll make the decision, the best decision every single time. if you know what your priorities are and you're clear on them. I'd think about it. Your priorities are your pathway. Number two, your guts are your guardian. Notice I had to make it a G thing, you know, the alliteration. But I don't mind saying it that way because your heart can be fooled. You know, feelings, depending on your feelings without adding some wisdom and thinking, boy, you can be in deep water really fast. Your feelings are a lousy compass. I mean, they feel wonderful. I mean, they're very vivid and exciting. But, you know, your feelings will land you in jail or dead. Your head will fool you too. Because our imagination takes over and, you know, we have thoughts and we think and pretty soon you create a thought and a plan and to you, you're looking at it, it seems very elegant. This is why smart people have such trouble. Because, wow, look at this thought I have. Well, it has no connection to reality. And they don't know that until they get out on the sidewalk in the street and learn it. Romans 1:19-20 talks about the guts. Not really. It doesn't mention them. Me'im is the word for bowels in the Old Testament, but it is your the deep awareness of your soul. That's what Scripture means when it says guts. Your heart will fool you, your head will fool you, but your guts, your bowels, your soul will tell you the truth. Ever tell you guys about my first marriage? It was terrible. Listen, I'm walking down the aisle way before I was a Christian. My guts are telling me, you fool. This is the worst mistake you've ever made. It's not too late. The exit's right there. If you bolt, she'll never catch you. But, you know, I'm thinking, my head, my heart. Oh, no, you know, she's pretty, she's smart. You know, the kids, we can work that out. No, it's going to be okay. Besides, we already sent out the invitations, you know. The cake's already made. No, it's going to be fine. If I'd listened to my guts, I could have saved myself 5 years of horror. On the other hand, I wouldn't be nearly as wise and handsome as I am today. Honestly, guys, my guts knew all the time. And every human being on this planet, in their guts, knows that God is Lord. They know it. That's what Romans 1 is all about. So when I say your guts are your guardian, if your head has something to say, that's great, and your heart, your feelings, that's great, but when your guts are talking to you, you need to be paying attention. If it's in your guts, and you know what I'm talking about, you need to listen to your guts. Because when that warning light goes off, as it should have for Lot, right about before he ran to Zoar, I mean, he should have been listening. John 16 actually speaks about how the Spirit of truth comes and speaks through your biblical bowels, your guts. But when he, the Spirit of truth, comes, he will guide you into all the truth. He will not speak in his own initiative, but whatever he hears, he will speak. And he will disclose to you what is to come. He shall glorify me, for he shall take of mine and shall disclose it to you. End of the message on the guts. I just really encourage you guys, listen carefully. Your priorities are your pathway. Your guts are your guardian. Your righteousness is not the same as your job review. Got Abraham over here, who's being pretty faithful. He's making good decisions, and he's pleasing God. And you got Lot that really couldn't find a good decision with his eyes open and both hands in front of him. Those guys are both declared righteous. They're on the same spectrum. We're going to see them both when we get home. The only thing they have in common is faith in God. If either one of those guys saw Jesus, they'd recognize him instantly. And they'd put all their trust in him. They say, I don't know much, but I know I'm going with you. Because you have the word of life. And the cross that you died on, the resurrection that lifted you out of the hole in the earth, the death that you overcame, the sin that you paid for, and the life you purchased for me, is all I'll ever want or ever need. You know, there's a verse I want to share with you that I think describes Lot. It's 1 Corinthians chapter 3, 11 to 15. For no man can lay a foundation other than the one which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. For if any man builds upon the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each man's work will become evident. For the day will show it, because it is to be revealed with fire. And the fire itself will test the quality of each man's work. And if any man's work which he's built upon it remains, he shall receive a reward. And if any man's work is burned up, he shall suffer loss, but he himself shall be saved, yet so as through fire. I'm glad he's going to be in heaven, but I'd rather have the reward. Just saying. Father, I'm afraid that way too often I'm more like Lot than I am like Abraham. And I'm feeling the smile of my brothers and sisters and feeling their nods. I know they're thinking that too. Father, there are times when we really feel capable, even tempted to feel worthy of your love. And there are times when we are just utterly, abjectly aware of how poor our bank account is in righteousness. Father, help us, please, not to be more righteous because you have already accomplished that, but to be more aware and less afraid of stepping out in faith, knowing that it is the righteousness of your Son that covers us. That when you peer into our file, you see his name. And when you look upon our lives, it gives you pleasure. Father, please continue to mold us, to shape us, to teach us, that we might at least grow closer and closer to the original source of that righteousness. For it's in his name that we thank you, love you, and pray your blessing. Amen.